we're in Revelation, the ninth chapter, and we started our sixth trumpet. And what we'd like to do here is, Ruth, would you read in Revelation 9, verse 13 through 17, and then Sister Gina, verses 18 through 21.
And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels, which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone.
By these three plagues was the third part of men killed, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone which proceeded out of their mouths. For the power of the horses is in their mouth and in their tails. For their tails are like unto serpents and have heads, and with them they hurt. And the rest of mankind who were not killed with these plagues repented not of the works of their hands, and they should not worship demons and the idols of gold and of silver and of brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they repented not of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts.
All right. Thank you very much. So last week we had closed out the fifth trumpet. We had begun the sixth. We had gotten into it just the first couple of verses. And I'll just make the suggestions, as we know and discuss, that Martin Luther was this sixth messenger trumpeting, and that there's this voice from the golden altar, or the horns of the golden altar before God. We talked about how that took us back into the eighth chapter to the golden altar, and that the prayers of saints were offered there with the incense, and just demonstrating that God, in response to the persecution of his truth and the persecution of his true people, offers these trumpets, these trumpet blasts, as his means of supporting them and of supporting his truths. And now that we're in the sixth trumpet, that's the same as the second woe. And so this is God's retaliation or counterattack to the rise of papacy and the downtrodding of his truths and of his holy name and of Jesus and of the truth people. And so each of the fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpet blasts are God's means of providing the appropriate truth through the proper truth people at that time in history in order to start to change the dynamics. The papacy had already achieved its zenith of power by the fourth stage of the church or fourth trumpet. And since then, there was serious elements of truth being promulgated along with the Bible being translated in the common language of the people, which was changing what was taking place in the Christian world. And then we talked about how the voice of God, as it were, comes to the sixth trumpeter saying, loose the four angels, which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And we talked about how the river, great river Euphrates supported ancient Babylon. So to the means of merchandise and such that and the people that support mystic Babylon, papacy. There are four angels, or as it were, that are had been restrained under the papal influence, which with the Great Reformation, these four restraint, these four elements were no longer restrained by the papacy. And with that Great Reformation, we have seen the political, financial, religious, and social aspects, the four cardinal points of earth, as it were, the universal aspects of what was going on in Christendom suddenly changed from being completely under the control of papacy. So it wasn't just a religious reformation, but it actually extended out further to every aspect of life and society at that time. And the four angels were loose, which were prepared for the hour, showing a very specific time that the Lord had in mind. And it was a day, a month, and a year. And we were talking about how that was October 31st of 1517 with Martin Luther's act, a simple act in his mind, even though it was very profound, it had ramifications that jumped out over the entire Christian world at the time. And the third part of men was slain was the, that's again, from the nominal point of view, those who accepted the Protestant message of truths, they were slain as far as being considered Christian. So the Roman Catholics viewed the Protestants as no longer having life as Christians. They were condemned. So that was, of course, this element of the outworking of this great effort of the Reformation. We were highlighting that only the fifth trumpet had a time period in it. And you remember that was the 5 months, mentioned twice for emphasis, which was 150 years, which brought us from John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation, 1367, to 1517, right to the year of the Great Reformation with Martin Luther. So we find that this expression, the hour, a day, a month, a year, that was profoundly projected by the fifth trumpet with these 5 months, and each month having 30 days, and the five times 30 days gets us 150 days, which represent 150 actual years. So we have our day, our month, and our year emphasized to us in the fifth trumpet, which brings us to the hour being the Great Reformation, as it were. And in fact, they celebrate in some of the Protestant churches still to this day what's called Reformation Day. And Reformation Day is October 31st in some of these churches, particularly Lutheran, which you can imagine why with Martin Luther. So they see it as a day. The Reformation Day as pronounced. So that's what we had discussed, and we're happy to entertain any comments or questions on that so far. All right. In our 16th verse, let's in fact read 16 through 18 again, and I know you could keep reading, but well, maybe 15. Sorry, 16 through 19. Let's read that again, Brother Mark. You want to do that for us, Mark Candle? I said that wrong, Mark Kinkowski. I was looking right at you.
Okay. The number of the armies of the horsemen was 200 millions. I heard the number of them, And this is how I saw in the vision the horses and those who sat on them. The riders had breastplates the color of fire and of hyacinth and of brimstone, and the heads of horses like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths proceed fire and smoke and brimstone. A third of mankind was killed by these three plagues, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone, which proceeded out of their mouths. 18, right? Stop at
19, please.
19. Okay. And for the power of the horses is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents and have heads, and with them they do harm.
Okay. Very good. So Brother Mark's translation said 200 million, I think. Some translations, like the Diaglot, say, I think, two myriads of myriads. We ran into this in the fifth chapter somewhat. It's a little different. But it seems as if the number is just huge, rather than meant to be 100% specific. But did anyone have a thought on that? So this huge cavalry force is listed, and so we're going to make a little notation in our minds. There are riders on the horses, and there are the horses. And in these verses, the emphasis is on the horses, not so much the riders. So when we look at this, we want to ask ourselves, what are the horses? And then that's very definitive. But then who would these riders be? And we'll entertain opening comments on any of that. Brother Mark.
Well, I mean, general, and this is during the sixth trumpet, I wrote my note down right here. So you got the Reformation going, and so, and then the horses are doctrines. And they said the power of the horses are in their mouths. So maybe it's the doctrines that are coming out, and finally, you know, the truth is finally getting out about all the false things that Babylon has been teaching. And then of course last week we talked about the destroyer. Yeah. The destroyer part in verse 12 or 11 there. So I don't know. It just seems like, well, the truth is finally coming out, and people are taking it in, I guess. Over.
No, that's very good. Thank you. That's great. Ruth.
I had a note that it was, those that were sympathetic to the doctrines of the Reformation, but some were sympathetic religiously and some were sympathetic politically. So you had the whole mass of people that were sympathetic to the Reformation, kind of like in harmony with what Brother Mark said, but that there were two classes.
Now, that's very good. We appreciate that. And instead of thinking that there's millions of different doctrines, the horses are doctrines, but it seems like the emphasis is that there's this huge horde of riders that were taking advantage of the doctrinal truths. And as Ruth is bringing out, they all weren't religiously or spiritually motivated. Political leaders, economic business people, many wanted to get out from underneath the restrictions of the papacy. And so there were, this is showing, as it were, a huge cavalry of people resisting the papal influence as these four angels are loosed out of the great river Euphrates, released from the papal restrictions because of this great Reformation. Of course, Martin Luther had in mind a spiritual religious Reformation, rehabilitation of the papacy and such. But it was far greater, because it was the hour. It was the Lord's time. All right, very good. Further comments? Brother Chris.
In the previous verse about those four angels being loosed, it does say that it was for to slay the third part of men. And typically, well, to slay them is to kill them. And we've brought out that killing or being killed is to convert. So typically when I think of being conversion, this is the goal. All these other influences of social, political, financial, etc., they all have an influence, but I've always thought of the conversion as being those that did convert by accepting the truth. And so that doesn't necessarily make it so, but the religious was the goal to bring men into that freedom. And that great number, we remember that these trumpets are from the nominal point of view, from their perspective, it's everywhere. It's like, yeah, we can't escape this. These locusts are everywhere. And it's affecting everything around us. So it's almost like a panic situation for them. Over.
All right. Very good. So true. All right. Thank you. Other comments? So then we were seeing that they have this breastplate of fire, jacinth, and brimstone. Fire, jacinth, and brimstone. And there's one simple observation that we want to make, that this breastplate would seem to be it's defensive. It's like body armor. And when we look at the next then we notice that the heads of the horses were like the heads of a lion's, and out of their mouths issue fire, smoke, and brimstone. So we have two common symbols between this breastplate and what issues forth out of the mouth of the lion-headed horse. The fire and the brimstone. Brimstone is sulfur. I think we all agree on that. Those two are common in both. And yet, there's a distinction. With the breastplate, there's the jacinth, a jewel. But with what comes out of the mouth, it's not the jacinth. It's smoke. Fire, smoke, and sulfur. So there's a similarity, and yet here's a distinction. What comes out of the mouth would be more offensive or attacking. What is the breastplate, covers the heart and all, is like a body armor. It defends those. So how would we go about interpreting these symbols? Well, one of the angles is that true doctrine, both defends the believer in it, as well as it attacks, as it were, it defeats the error. So that you and I, simply, we use truth to defend our thinking in our hearts, but we also use the truth, as it were, to defeat error when we present it. So as a body armor, we see that the truth has this thought of it, the fiery judgment on one hand, but for it consumes error and it destroys error. It's a complete destruction of error. The sulfur you breathe it, it's poisonous. So No one can fire arrows of error at the saints who have on the breastplate, the armor of God, and overcome the truth that we believe. because the breastplate will completely defeat or kill, as it were, any arrows that would be fired at us. But on the other hand, being a gemstone, did someone have the color for Jason as a gemstone? I know the gemstones can be a challenge. Brother Dan.
I have blue.
And what's that suggest for us?
Faithfulness.
So how would that fit in as a breastplate of truth?
Well, the truth would keep those who have it faithful to God. It would protect them from error. Over.
Okay. Very good. Anyone else on that? Sister Ruth and then Sister Debbie.
I have a note that it's highly reflective, so it would be along the lines of the breastplates of fire and Jason, that it would just reflect back at you. It would like blind you if you tried to attack it. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Sister Debbie?
Yeah, when I think of blue, I think of the water. Even the water is really doesn't have a color. It's like pure, clear, you know, like that glassy, you know, surface that the saints stand on. It reflects blue and water to me is like the word of God. So you have not only the faithfulness, but you have the faithfulness of the word of God that is your protection. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Good. Anyone else? Brother David?
Brother Rick, I was thinking about the idea of faithfulness to God's plan and that it maintains our standing. It's kind of just a different way of looking at it. In other words, if the errors can't get to you, you're standing under the might of the flag of the Most High and completing his will. Over.
Okay, good. Very good. Other comments? So in a simple... In kind of a simpleton's way, I look at it that the truth is faithful. It will never let us down. It's faithful to us. It's faithful as a breastplate. It protects us. The truth is true blue. And it will defeat any errors that are fired our way. It will devour them with fire and sulfur. Completely destroy error as it might attack us. So the writers of the Reformation, they were protected from the papal errors by the truths that they were learning from the Word of God now being in their own language. But then we see how it turns and that the horses have the heads like lions. And we see that the lion had issued out of their mouth, like a roaring lion, fire, smoke, and brimstone. So I think we can see similarly the fire and the brimstone or sulfur as defeating and consuming error as it's spoken out. That the lion is God's justice, the reasonableness and the justice of God's true doctrines as opposed to papacy. But how about this smoke element? You might remember that we have some of these same features back with Brother John Wycliffe. We see some of these same elements being presented. Sister Debbie and then Ruth.
Yeah, I wanted to mention something about the lion's heads that, you know, I never thought of it before and it just recently, you know, within the last year came to my attention. That, well, number one, Jesus is the Lion of Judah, and he is the way, the truth, and the life. And right again, you have this idea of the doctrines of truth horses, heads being like lions, that's Jesus. And, but the adversary, when he goes around like a roaring lion, well, it's like a roaring, he's not a lion. He tries to pretend to be a roaring lion, but he's not. And I really, cause I used to worry about, oh man, he's, you know, like a lion, but he's not. You know, he's a counterfeit. He tries to pretend to be a roaring lion. And the truth is the roaring lion, what, you know, coming out of the mouth, like you said, is, you know, destroys the errors and is the Lord, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's the Lord. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Ruth.
Well, the purpose of smoke is to obscure. You can't see. It's like fog. You can't see where you're going, so it obscured and blinded the enemy so that they couldn't advance against it. They were like stymied. Over.
All right, that's good. I want to double check. Do you have your internet connection plugged in? You broke up just a little bit. Just double check. Okay. All right. Further comments? Brother David.
Brother Rick, I wanted to make a comment also about the blue, and then another comment if I could. The blue reminded me of the sands of the seashore, the blue there, and then the stars of heaven, the blue there, which would be God's purpose, which would be pictured in that faithfulness. In other words, it's not diverting at all from his plan, and his plan is to bless all of mankind. So this keeps us on that path. And then, let's see, I forgot my other comment. Thank you.
All right. Well, raise your hand again. No problem. Thank you, Brother David. Sister Debbie.
Speaking of paths, I like that idea. The smoke, blinds, like Sister Ruth out, it blinds the enemy, but it stops them on the path of error. They can't go that continue down their path of error because they can't see it anymore. It's like, reminds me of the, when you present the truth properly to someone, like at the fair, you know, like you have where you can ask them questions and they answer and it kind of leads them to the truth. They can't, they're stuck, you know, like Ruth said, stymied. They can't continue on their path of error at all. They have to stop. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. For the comments. Valen.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is fitting at all, but I was thinking, Brother Rick, that the smoke is evidence of the fire, and the fire, of course, picturing the destructive power of the truth to error. So, it would be an evidence. And of course, the lion, picturing, justice or the just, ways of God, the just ways of the truth. The ability of the truth to destroy error would be evident by the smoke. Over.
All right. Thank you, Brother Dan. I appreciate that. Sister Alice.
I just wondered where we got blue as the color, because when I'm looking it up, everything that I found, it says it's red, yellow.
Okay.
The color of Jason. So where did we get blue?
Okay, that's a reasonable question. So, Sister Alice, under jacinth, is it using that same word, or is it converting it to another gem word? Just out of curiosity, because sometimes they do that.
It's using it as Jason's, the word Jason.
Okay.
I Googled it.
Yeah.
And everything that I saw had red, yellow.
Okay.
So where did we come up with blue? That's all I want to know is where we come up with blue.
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see here. I see Brother Adi, but Brother David Victory, you raised your hand too.
Thank you, Brother Rick. Just a small comment. It made me think the comments of tabernacle shadows, the way that a shadow leads to the light, and the tabernacle shadows led to the sacrifice of Christ, the great light of his sacrifice. And the same thing, same kind of idea with smoke. It leads you back to the truth. It does the destruction, but once it's the fire does the destruction, but once the smoke is there, it leads you back to the truth, because there's nothing else but the truth once your ear is destroyed. Over.
All right. Thank you. Brother Adi.
Just a reading from the NIV that it says their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue, and yellow as sulfur. And if you look at what's coming out of their mouths, fire, which would be red smoke, which can be blue, and sulfur, which is yellow. So they sort of coincide together. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Adi. Ruth?
Just looking it up in Strong's, it has deep blue, but it doesn't have it. It has it being Jason translated, but the derivation is from the word hyacinth.
Yeah.
So that's just a thought.
Very good. That's the word I was thinking it got translated to. Good. Thank you. Sister Brenda.
I was really confused too, because when I was thinking of hyacinth, and hyacinth is a flower that has a very deep blue color. And then I was looking at something because I had Sister Alice's same thought, but what I read, and I can't find it again now, is that at one time it was referred to as a sapphire, that instead of the hyacinth, and because we get our hyacinth blue flower. So I was wondering, where do we get that, and where is the correlation? So as I was reading it, they said it could have been referred to as a sapphire. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Good. More information. Sister Debbie?
Well, I had a note that the color of jacinth could have originally been blue-violet, since the name is derived from the Latin hyacinthus, referring to the flowering plant still known today as hyacinth. Over.
All right. Thank you. So, my experience over the years in dealing with gemstones are always a challenge in the scriptures to really always be 100%. Sometimes we are more than others. But fortunately, Sister Brenda, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I must not have taken my hand out. I'll do okay. That.
All
thank
right.
You.
So, fortunately, we've generally been able to understand that a gemstone is hard, crystallized, and has the thought of being able to radiate light, reflect light back, and the property of the stone would reflect, that would determine the color that it reflects, generally speaking. And so we draw lessons from their coloration. This breastplate, as this gemstone, it puts forth this light as brought out, a reflecting light. But I had thought of it as a dark blue. So I thought of it as representing the faithfulness that the doctrines faithfully protect those who believe them. But if it's different, and someone has a nice interpretation, we're happy to entertain that too. Certainly no problem. Sister Debbie.
Well, you know, a lot of times you look it up and it says that it's like the red, a red brown, orange, whatever, reddish in color. Of course, it brings out that you know, the blood of the Lord is red, and you have this ransom that is also a covering. You know, as long as we keep Christ's righteousness, the covering of his blood on us, then, you know, that's also like a breastplate, a protection. Over.
All right. Thank you. So we're going to move forward. Let each be convinced in their own mind. The breastplate is the defensive, protective aspect of how the truth at the time of the Reformation was protecting the brethren and those who believed in them from the errors of the adversary. It would completely consume and destroy any errors, any darts or arrows of the adversary. The truth would protect the wearers. But then out of the mouth, this lion's roar, this is more of the offensive. And so the same destruction, a complete destruction, fire as judgment and consuming, sulfur as completely killing, it destroys the air. And the smoke might, in association with that, this reminds us that to the Catholics, the papists, these truths were very confusing and disorientating. And it was a smoke in which it blocked out their counterfeit sun, their counterfeit message, as we saw back in the fifth trumpet, chapter 9, verse 1 and 2. The smoke went up and it darkened the sun. And that there was a counterfeit sun. It was the papacy's interpretation of the gospel, which is contains error, as we know. So, as an offensive message, the truth of the Reformation put the papists in confusion, and it destroyed the errors. But we see that in verse 18, by these three was the third part of men killed. The fire, the smoke, and the brimstone or sulfur, which issued out of their mouths, and has brought out that was showing that third were the Protestants who died as Roman Catholics being converted to Protestantism because of the power of the truth when it was spoken forth. And it overwhelmed and destroyed the papal errors for them. But in verse 19, we see that there's also a power in the mouth and in their tails. The tails are like serpents with heads. And with these heads of the serpents, they hurt. And so we notice that it's not saying that they were killed or converted to Protestantism. But it's showing that in some way the Reformation truths continue to have this effect. Comments on this aspect, the tails like serpents with heads. Brother Dan.
I was just thinking, Brother Rick, like in the Catholic Bible I have, that has all kinds of notes to try to put forth their doctrine. So the truth, like a snake with a poisonous bite, it shows that, it poisons, what the Catholic Church is trying to teach. It poisons their errors and kills it. Of course, they try to revive it and keep it, you know, keep it before their people, if you will. But it's very difficult to destroy the truth. But I'll just leave it there. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Good, Ruth.
I had the thought that at the end of the Reformation, toward the end, it was divided up into a lot of different reformers. You know, it's like at first it started with Luther, and then toward the end of the period, you had more and more, like, seemed like every country in Europe you went to, there was a reformed church that was like joining the fray, so that the tales at the end were like multitudes over.
All right, very good. That certainly has happened historically. Other comments? So in one sense, we see that the Reformation came in with a lion's roar. It was very powerful, had a marked day, even called the Reformation Day, and it really had this tremendous impact all across society. But it didn't go away. It continued to pain or hurt the papists throughout the entire sixth trumpet period. It didn't let them off the hook, so to speak. All these doctrinal truths continued, perceived to be as like serpents, and many of them. And with each head, there was an ability to hurt. So instead of one lion's roar, which is plenty, you have all these serpent heads, and they're all speaking forth their truths, or putting forth their truths. And to the papists, that was like poison, and it pained them. So it didn't go away. The truths, maybe it's true, the aspect of the Great Reformation subsided somewhat. And as Ruth was commenting, many different denominations and groupings came out of that over the following centuries. But it did, the truths continued to pain those of papacy. Other comments on this symbol? Sister Molly or Brother James?
It's Sister Molly. Good morning. I was just thinking, along with what you were saying about the poison or like the venom of the scorpion, just how it's hard to ignore once that's been injected inside of the system, they kind of had to deal with it. It kind of makes things worse once it's inside of you. And so just that idea of these truth doctrines, people had questions in their mind then that they had to deal with, regarding the papal error. So over.
All right. Very good. So true. So true. And we see in our next verse 20, it starts out, and the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues. In other words, it's showing they were pained, but they weren't killed. Very good. Kind of reminds us of the men who were tormented back in the fifth trumpet, who longed for death. The truth back then, under the morning star of the Reformation with Brother Wycliffe, it tormented men, but the time for the Great Reformation was still set for the hour, the day, the month, and the year. And so we see that effect. But not all are converted. That's the point. And those who aren't continue to be tormented by these truths. Sister Debbie.
Now, I have a question. It seems like Revelations talks a lot about thirds. Like the third of men, the third of trees, the third of this, you know, of whatever. Is there a reason for that, or is it actually a third of the population left papacy? Is it really a third, or is that just some kind of representation, or why a third? Over.
Okay, does anyone like to answer that for us?
Just noticing. Other Dan? I have more muscle in them. I don't know if
it's that obvious. Well, I probably shouldn't raise my hand because I don't have a clear answer, but a third doesn't represent a numerical third, but it represents a portion of society at that time. So a third who were killed to papacy became alive to the truth movement of the Protestant movement. So the so it shows a portion of society at the time we're speaking of. Over.
All right. Very good. And so I'm going to continue down the line of hands, and let's see what we got. Sister Alice and then Ruth.
I'm sorry. I have a question that I didn't pick up if we answered it.
Okay.
In the 19th verse, it had an hour, a day, a month, and a year. And the day is not in the Sinaitic, so it would be hour, month, and year. And we, I think, come up with 390. And I'm just wondering, what was the beginning and the end of that? What two dates, beginning and end of that?
I'm sorry, Sister Alice. I probably didn't hear you right. I thought you said verse 19, but that's not what you said, is it?
No, I said 15.
15. Okay, so it's not an hour, it's the hour in the Greek, the hour. It's the hour, a day, a month, and a year.
But the day is not in the Sinaitic.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't have that marked out. Okay.
Okay, so that would be a total of how many years, and when does it begin and when does it end?
I don't add it up as a number of years. My opening comment and my closing comments last week, I was offering the suggestion that the hour was speaking about the time of the Great Reformation, and that I had assumed the word day was there, so you might not accept this, but I thought the day was October 31st. The day was the 31st. The month is October, and the year is 1517. My reasoning was that in the previous trumpet, we had 5 months stated twice. We had 5 months mentioned in the ninth chapter, verse 5, and again in verse 10, that the men were hurt or tormented for 5 months. Now, the 5 months we did interpret as a month consisting of 30 days times 5. 5 times 30 would be 150 days, which would then be 150 years, a day for a year. So that unique amongst the trumpets is this time feature, giving us the period of time of that fifth trumpet from 1367 with John Wycliffe to 1517 with Martin Luther. And the emphasis is to bring us in the sixth trumpet to start with this hour, the hour of the Great Reformation. And that October 31st, 1517 is recognized as being the Reformation Day, still celebrated by some in Lutheran churches. So that was how I was interpreting that. But we're happy if someone has an alternate understanding, if they'd like to share it, we're happy to entertain that. And if not now, if someone thinks of something later, that's all good. Ruth.
Well, I had raised my hand in regard to the three parts.
Yeah, please do.
But it's three, we've been talking about it throughout the whole trumpets. But it's three parts of society at the time. So in this particular case, the third part that was killed were those who converted to Protestantism. That would be one of the three parts. But the other two parts would be those who remained Catholic and then those who were the political part. So you have down in verse 20, and the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not. So that would be the other two-thirds who remained Catholic. And then you have all the idol worship and idols of gold and brass and stone that really, and sorceries and fornication, it really shows that the remainder of the two-thirds remained Catholic and they continued all the image worship and practices of Catholicism. So you have three parts in any, whenever it says a third, you have three parts, but the third that was killed were those that converted to Protestantism. So it's not a numeric third. Over.
All right. Very good. So the friends will remember that in the first, second, third, and fourth trumpets, we read about one third in each of those. And we had a very good discussion. And we gave an application in all four of those first trumpets. The fifth trumpet doesn't mention a third. And the seventh trumpet does not mention a third. So here again, in this sixth trumpet regarding the thirds, we're applying it the same way we did in the first four trumpets, that these are just denoting three primary aspects or divisions amongst the people at that time. And in this sense here, as Ruth was bringing out, we also have understood, you know, like the brethren have suggested, that the ones who were slain were those who accepted Protestantism, and they were considered dead as Christians from the papacy point of view. So the other two parts are those who didn't accept Protestantism. The one could be Roman Catholics as a religious sense, and the other ones might be those who just weren't so inclined to get involved, like the political or civil element. But they just aren't particularly being mentioned in this way. But the emphasis, though, still is the one-third part that was killed. That's what the Lord's word seems to want to highlight for us. All right, Sister Debbie and then Sister Cheryl.
I was wondering, because usually if you have three parts of something, it's one type of thing. It could be religious society, which would have been Protestant, Catholic, and heathen. The heathen would kind of fit in with those that worship the idols, you know, gold and silver and brass and stone and wood. That would be more like the heathen religions that weren't affected. I hate to, you know, like if you have a third of like civil society, you know, you have the government, you have the people, you have, you know what I'm saying? So maybe it's talking more here about religious society, the three parts of religious society, which, you know, you could have your atheists, like you brought out, the civil could be just those who didn't care, who were atheist or heathen. Over.
All right. Thank you, Sister Debbie. Sister Cheryl.
Well, it just reminded me of Revelation 16:13, where we have our three spirits as frogs, and it is defined as being the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, which we know is the civil Protestant Catholic religion. So it kind of relates that three, determining what that would be. Over. For me. Over.
Yeah, I think that's very good, because that's the three parts of the great city, a few verses down in Revelation 16, that falls apart eventually. So that's what constitutes the great city, Mystic Babylon. All right, very good. Good suggestions. So we're just going to keep moving forward, but if someone has a comment, so we go backwards, we're happy to entertain it, because I know thoughts have to percolate. So I'm just moving forward, and we get also a little more information as we go forward in these verses, and we'll just see if it helps us. Brother Jeff, could you read for us Revelation 9, verse 20 and 21, please?
The rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons and idols of gold, silver, bronze, stone, and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or walk. Nor did they repent of their murders, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts.
All right. Thank you, Brother Jeff. So, Brother, I want to highlight a point because it happens to be something else we're currently having an assignment that we're working on, that we've been working on. But this has been a nice insight from the scriptures that we learn that these trumpets, these trumpeted truths are called plagues. And so it assists us in our understanding of the seven last plagues, seven last plagues in which the wrath of God is filled up, which is brought out in Revelation, the 15th chapter and the 16th chapter. If we have seven last plagues, it's telling us that we should look for previous plagues. And the previous plagues, I think we're being told here in this verse, are the trumpets. And the trumpets are truth messages that have blasted forth. And people could accept them or reject them during the gospel age, these different trumpet blasts. But it would plague them who didn't convert or accept the truths. And it would plague them because the truth would sear their consciences. So they would be pained by it if they didn't convert and be killed. So the thought is the seven last plagues, they too are truths, condensed truths. But because the wrath of God is filled in these last plagues, they aren't trumpeted forth where they could be ignored by some. They're poured out on them. They're poured out on the nominal systems so that they have to experience what to do with these plaguing truths. And that'll be God's way of eventually burning the bundle tares and leads to the destruction of the nominal systems. Because in those seven last plagues, his wrath is fulfilled. So I just took a moment to wanted to highlight that part here because I think, and for me, in my mind, when it says last plagues in Revelation, we look for earlier plagues. And here is a place where we read that these trumpet blasts of truth were plaguing those who didn't accept them. Sister Debbie.
Just real quick question, just to orient it in my mind because my mind is not what it used to be. The seven last plagues are during the seventh trumpet over?
My humble opinion is that they're a future event still, but yes, it's during the seventh trumpet. Okay. In our verse, Brodin.
Well, just to say what you already said, Brother Rick, it makes a really good connection in my mind to be able to say more clearly that the seven last plagues are truths that have that plaguing effect because, like we're saying, when we say last, that means you have to look and see that there was something that came before it. And so here we have this connection showing that these trumpets that came before the seven last plagues were also truths blasted out, and they had this effect over.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Sister Debbie?
One more thing about that. the seventh messenger brought out is like that seventh trumpet was one big truth, maybe the ransom and what it was really about. And then you have maybe seven sub-truths that pastor brought out, like the Trinity, et cetera, that go under that. It could be like one, and then you have A, B, C, D, E, you know. But the main, what I'm trying to think of is the main truth that pastor brought out would have been the truth about the ransom, right? Over.
Well, it tells us in the 10th chapter, which we won't get to today, but in the 10th chapter and in verse 7, chapter 10, verse 7, Ruth highlights to me that sometimes I forget to say the chapter and it's pretty confusing when I'm jumping around. So chapter 10, verse 7, in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to trumpet, the mystery of God should be finished, as he hath declared to his servants, the prophets. Brother Russell expresses on this verse in the first volume, page 87, volume 1, page 87, that both mysteries would be complete in the seventh trumpet. The divine plan of the ages would be revealed, and Christ in you, the mystery of Christ in you, the hope of glory, that the church would be complete in the seventh trumpet. So both mysteries would be completed during that seventh trumpet period. So the seventh trumpet is the third woe. So when the seventh trumpet sounded, Brother Russell's harvest message went forth. That trumpet blast was a severe woe to the nominal systems. But the seven last plagues of truth, we think, will be poured out in the future after all the Lord's people have come out of her, that they do not receive of her plagues. So that's kind of this concept that not Brother Russell's message has been a terrible woe to the nominal church. It's been trumpet blasted, and it's been truths. It's been the harvest truths, gathering the wheat, gathering the Lord's people out of the nominal systems. No more a reformation period. Now it's a harvest and an abandoning the nominal systems period before its final destruction. So, okay, we'll leave it there at that. Lord willing, we'll be coming up to that in time. But coming back to our sixth trumpet in Revelation 9, verse 20, as the friends have pointed out, these truths continue to plague those who were not killed or converted by accepting the truths coming forth. And it tells us that they don't repent of their works, of their hands. And it's demonstrating the willfulness on the part of the papists, the Roman Catholics, that continue to reject the truths. And so because they continue to reject them, they aren't converted or killed. They continue to be plagued or tormented because the truths are so beautiful and powerful and harmonious and compared to the papal doctrines and teachings and practices. But we have this work of their hands brought out. The worship, they didn't repent. So they continue to worship devils and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see, nor hear, nor walk. Well, what might this represent to us? Well, we'll make an offer. Okay, good. Ruth.
Well, it's just kind of a simple explanation, but that was one of the cries of the Reformation, that there was all this worship of saints and icons and things like that, that in some instances they were being burnt and destroyed to revolt against Rome. So that's almost taking it literally, but it just shows what God thinks of Catholicism. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. You know, I was, good, Brother Dan.
I was thinking for devils, the doctrines of devils, they continued to worship these doctrines, hellfire and immortal soul and Trinity and so on. Over.
You got a verse for that? That one?
My brain is frozen.
Okay. Why don't you read for us, or Sister Connie, why don't you read for us? 1 Timothy 4, verses 1. In fact, 1 through 3.
But the Spirit saith expressly that in later times some shall fall away from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, through the hypocrisy of men that speak lies, branded in their own conscience as with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats which God created to be received with thanksgiving by them that believe and know the truth. We see that for sure in the Catholic Church, especially the forbidding to marry and abstaining from meats and all these rules that they were given as commandments, sort of, you know, or if you do these things, you know, you're sinning. And let's see. So, yeah, definitely is really magnifies the Catholic Church in my opinion, these verses.
All right, very good. That's why I hit the nail on the head, Sister Connie. And when you were a little girl, was there a restriction on eating meat?
Oh yeah. So on Friday during Lent, you couldn't eat meat. My mom kept that pretty good, you know, except when she started forgetting what day it was. So we didn't really. Didn't follow that when she lived here, so.
And then I think that got rescinded in our lifetime.
All the people who got punished for that, just now it all changed.
So. Quite amazing. Quite amazing. Thank you. I know Debbie.
Just real quick, I mean, verse 20 to me sounds like the religious element, you know, the demons and worshiping stuff, but verse 21 reminded me of, you know, when it was brought out about the dragon. That sounds more like governmental stuff, you know, murders, sorceries, whoredoms, or their thefts, you know. That really does sound like the civil government, you know, especially murders and thefts. Over.
All right, thank you. Brother David.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just also thinking about Jeremiah 7 as another scripture for the right over. But that would be mostly chastising Israel and all they went through. But the same idolatries are mentioned in there and also about the Molech worshipers. Over.
Indeed. Okay. Very good. I know from my own mind, I had looked at these, the gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood. The point being that they were works of their hands. These are things that they actually made and that they literally, the Lord is saying this is idolatry because you created something here that you worship in some element, but they can't hear or walk, just like, what Israel had done in their own way. But what I would suggest instead of what it's showing is that the Catholics have their genuflexing in front of certain saints, whether it's a picture or a statue. They have their crucifix. They have their saint worships of dead saints. they have relic worship where they still, to this day, they have different relics of antiquity that they send out from time to time to be worshipped and adored by the people in various churches. And in fact, the friends have read this, that back at Rome in the Vatican, that there's a special room which is filled with drawers with little bits of relic, and every altar at a Catholic church is supposedly sent one of these pieces or relics for the altar to help sanctify it. They have their holy water. I remember going with a friend to Catholic church and picking up the sponge and the holy water when he first walked in the door, and he goes, "What are you doing?" And I put it down, and people were mortified all around me. Brother,
So a good friend of ours is a Catholic teacher, and what the church did is they brought into the school the bones of a saint, a child that was a saint. And they brought it before the kids. And I mean, it was macabre, but you got to imagine what impact that has on the children to do something like that and worship bones of a dead girl.
Yes. Right. So weird. Sister Brenda.
I have a reference for verse 25 for Daniel 5:23, and it talks about the idols, and it's basically, to paraphrase it, it says it, they worship the idols rather than worshiping God who gave life and breath. Over.
Okay, so true. Very good. Brother David.
We're never surprised what the world comes up with, but it's kind of surprising. I know when they have news commentaries, they're not supposed to comment on anything on the things they're mentioning. But yesterday or the day before, the news does a lot of advertising for new products, and Coors came out with a new beer where they had holy water in it. It was so repulsive. The very idea that would be something holy is a joke and sacrilegious. And that's what the commentator said it strikes me as sacrilegious.
Well, good for him. Not that we believe holy water, but anything related to the Lord shouldn't be used in such a way. Okay, well, thank you for that. Sister Brenda, a follow-up? Okay. Sister Molly, you had your hand up.
I did, but I'm going to pass. Thank you very much.
All right. And then we would add candles, the lighting of candles, and the incense. And then there was the one, I'm not thinking of the proper word. I think of it starting with an M, but I'm not thinking of the proper word. It's a Roman Catholic word. And it's what the host was worshipped in, and they would parade it. Brother David.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, Brother Rick. A monstrance.
Yeah, that's it.
A comment on it was one thing that I remember from just being a Catholic. And art history, I think it was Bernini, came up with a monstrance that was like a radiant sun. And it was just spellbinding. And it really gets to the point where art becomes, you know, something like we've all mentioned, the word idolatrous. Because it takes the place of something holy.
All right, very good. And that's the right word. I don't know the right spelling, but if you Google it, but some of you undoubtedly have seen like a Roman Catholic parade. Well, they'll have this sunburst, like Brother David is saying, all golden, and it'll be carried on a staff or in some prominent way, and the host is in there, and they're worshiping this. And they genuflex, and they beat their chests, and they make the sign of the cross and these various things. So I couldn't help but wonder if in our chapter 9, verse 20, these works of their hands, it was indeed pointing out that the Roman Catholics did not repent of all these forms of idolatry, that when you go to a Protestant church, all of that is absent. The most you generally will ever see is an empty cross. And I remember asking my father once as a little boy, why they have the Roman Catholics have a crucifix and our cross is empty. And he says, we emphasize what the angel said at the tomb. And that is, he is risen. He's not here. But the Catholic emphasis is that their priests recreate Christ and crucify him afresh in the act of transubstantiation. And so they have the emphasis on the suffering and dying Christ because that's what their priests recreate. Whereas the Protestants say, no, it was done once for all. And this goes back to the cry of the Reformation, the just shall live by faith. So, brethren, we'll have to close here. We will come back to this if someone would like to comment more on verse 20. Otherwise, we'll pick up with verse 21. And then I want to say in regards to the 10th chapter, we will read from it. So make a note. Have your third volume, and it's page 89, volume 3, page 89. Brother Russell deals with a few of the verses here, which we will capitalize on. And you might also, because we think there's this a reference to Daniel 12, we think there's a correlation between Revelation 10 in part and Daniel 12 in part. And so you might want to refresh your memory on Daniel 12, and it's bigger than this, but one of the pages is also in the third volume, page 69. I think that kind of puts you in the middle of it. So, but you'll know, and you'll have your notes, but we're going to put some of that together. You and I remembering that it was during the sixth trumpet, the latter end of the sixth trumpet, that as, but still part of the sixth trumpet period, that we have our Daniel 12, the end of the 1260 years being realized at the time of the end. And so we're suggesting that we have some connections there, and, but, more next week.